Hello, welcome to Australia Talks. Paul Barclay here with you once again on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia and online. Australia has plenty of great national parks. Most of you will have been to at least one of them, gone for a hike or camped at one at some stage, enjoyed a cup of tea perhaps by the campfire in front of your tent. But when does development of our parks enhance your experience as a visitor, and when does it impinge on the natural environment? The New South Wales government has just introduced laws to define how much private development is permitted in national parks. Environmentalists fear the amendment to the New South Wales National Parks and Wildlife Act may open parks up to hotels, shopping centres, restaurants, sports centres. The New South Wales government says no, it doesn't do that. It strengthens environmental safeguards. Who's right? How much development is too much, and what kind of development do you want to see in your national parks? I'd love your views. Call us right now on 1300 22 55 76. You'll need to call right now from the Northern Territory and South Australia. You can also join us online. Just search ABC Australia Talks and you can post us your comments and I can read some of those out on air. Let me introduce you first of all, though, today to Sally Barnes, the head of the New South Wales National Parks and Wildlife Service, and Peter Prineas, writer and former chair of the Nature Conservation Council of New South Wales. Sally Barnes, to you first of all, welcome to Australia Talks.
Good evening, Paul.
Sally, so this amendment to the Act, does it broaden the scope of the development that is allowed in national parks? Does it, in essence, allow for more private development, as some environmentalists are suggesting?
No, well, the National Parks and system has welcomed visitors ever since the first park in Australia in 1879, the National Park, which became the Royal National Park, and it was the second national park in the world. And there were always those early parks and parks there after those were established for people to come and enjoy the great outdoors as well as protecting the conservation values. So we've actually been proactively planning in New South Wales what we put on offer to visitors, what visitors want, how we match their expectations. And as we went through that planning process to be more open to people, to make access to parks easier to people who might be non-park visitors, what we found was that the current Act could be read up or it could be read down. And if you read the previous Act up, it would mean you could let all sorts of development into parks, including large hotels, supermarkets, bowling alleys, the full works, because there is a section in the Act which was clearly designed to have private commercial operators come in and assist us provide visitor facilities. And the previous Act talked about accommodation, hotels, and a whole range of things. So what we wanted to do was to say, how do we encourage people into parks? How do we take them to places where we as park workers go and are just marvelled? But how do we do it in a way that protects the park, protects the environment for future generations?
Okay,
so we think we've struck that balance.
You're saying then that these amendments actually limit the private development of national parks, don't increase the prospect of more of it that could possibly occur?
Certainly does not broaden it to any uses that weren't possible before, but what it does do is constrain, it actually sets criteria for the scale, the size, and the sorts of developments that are appropriate. So we've introduced sustainability criteria, which really constrain what is appropriate. Well, really for the first time makes it quite clear that national parks are special places. They're places where people expect to go and have as near a natural experience as possible, but that doesn't mean it's only camping and it doesn't mean it's only one size fits all.
Okay, and we'll look at what that might mean a little bit later. But Peter Prineas from, formerly from the Nature Conservation Council, what's the problem here? This would seem to actually reduce the prospect of enhanced development of national parks.
Oh, well, Paul, I don't believe you can take that interpretation of this amendment. What the bill has done, the bill introduced by Frank Sartor, the minister, has been to broaden the purposes for which tourism leases can be granted. They do this by permitting in national parks new, and I emphasise new, developments for such things as conference and function centres, sporting and educational facilities, restaurants, shops and other tourist facilities. Now, Previously, these purposes were specified only for existing buildings and structures.
So those purposes are spelt out, are you saying, in the Act?
Yes, but they in the old Act, in the Act as it applied before, these purposes only applied to existing buildings, which are a tiny proportion of national parks, less than a thousandth of 1% of the total area of parks. Now, these purposes can be contemplated for new buildings, which in some national parks may extend over the whole of the area of the park as a possibility for you could look at any area of the park and have a new building with one of these functions.
Sally Barnes has just said, though, that there will be greater safeguards to ensure that such overdevelopment doesn't occur, that the right balance is struck.
Well, I don't agree with that, and I think any reasonable person reading the amendment would not agree with it. The the Act, as it previously stood, was subject to the interpretation of the courts. There was a long line of cases that interpreted the National Parks and Wildlife Act over many years, and they applied a very strict and narrow interpretation of what could be allowed. This amendment has enhanced the discretion of the Minister, Frank Sartor, so that he can approve a wide range of tourism uses as long as he is satisfied that certain requirements laid down in the Act have been met.
Mm.
Now, this reduces drastically the oversight that has up to now been exercised by the courts over development in national parks. The line of cases that I mentioned, which lay down principles for the use and development of parks, will to a large extent no longer be applicable.
Mm.
And the ability of the public to restrain development in national parks by going to the courts has been reduced by the great expansion of the Minister's discretion.
Peter, I'm going to take some calls, and we'll also hear a response from Sally Barnes from the National Parks and Wildlife Service, Peter Prineas, our other guest, former chair of the Nature Conservation Council and writer. Let's head around the country, though, now with your thoughts about national parks, whether their primary purpose is conservation. Should they be doing more to welcome more visitors there? And what does this mean for the extent of development that you're comfortable with in national parks? Keith in Sydney is first up. Hi, Keith.
Hi.
G'day.
G'day. Look, national parks were set aside for nature, and nature conservation is their primary purpose. And tourism development, the development of facilities, defeats that very purpose of reserving and setting aside those areas. And it does it by providing road access, power, sewer, water, garbage collection, fire protection, pest management, and all those sorts of activities impact upon the national parks. And therefore, the national park is diminished by that.
So you're saying that all of those things that you just mentioned shouldn't, in fact, be occurring in national parks?
No, and indeed, in Victoria this week, there was an announcement that their ecotourism push was going to be not inside, but next to national parks. And that's exactly what should be happening around Australia, where there is a partnership, a real partnership, where the parks are providing the enjoyment, but the facilities for development of accommodation and whatever is outside the park.
Okay, and Keith. Yeah, no, thanks for your view. I'm going to move on to Don, who's close to a beautiful part of Australia in the Blue Mountains. Hello, Don.
Hello, Paul. Thanks for the program. I'm in the Blue Mountains.
Mm.
It is indeed a wonderful part of Australia. And as a bushwalker and someone with a more than an entry-level knowledge about conservation biology, the thing that I think about in respect to tourism and other forms of development in national park are impacts. And the fact of the matter is that current forms of economic analysis are very poor at describing the impacts. What could have happened with this recent tourism legislation would be changes that would help improve the long-term future of national parks, but that hasn't happened.
We just heard from the National Parks and Wildlife Service, and they say actually it has.
Where's the evidence? I've been asking for evidence to justify the spurious claims about the benefits of commercial tourism development in national parks, about the benefits of having commercial tour operators going to wilderness areas. I've been asking for evidence to support those spurious assertions for nearly a year and a half. My submission was hand-delivered to Sally Barnes.
We will hear more from Sally Barnes in a moment. Thanks for your call, though, Don, to West Hobart now and James. Hello, James.
Good evening. Thank you, ABC.
Yeah, obviously Tasmania has some spectacular national parks. What's your thought about a change of interpretation where we should be more welcoming of visitors, that should be as important as nature conservation, and that might mean that we need to consider further development of the parks?
Yes. Firstly, I'm surprised that this subject is even being considered, and I'll make three quick points. Any example of private enterprise in our national parks that I've seen has been nothing less than an abject total failure. Point two, we shouldn't forget that the National Parks and Wildlife Service was intended to be just that, national parks, to be a Commonwealth facility. And lastly, that national parks exist to conserve, full stop. And we shouldn't forget that these are our national parks, and I'll leave it at that. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks for your call, James. 1300 22 55 76. I'll take some more calls in a moment. But if I can come back to you, Sally Barnes, the head of the National Parks and Wildlife Service in New South Wales. Concern in particular seems to focus on the ministerial discretion that's now allowable under the Act, and that there aren't enough safeguards, that essentially the minister will be able to decide what goes on in those national parks. How do you respond to those concerns?
That's not the case, in that there haven't been any changes to the object of the Act, and certainly the same calls to the courts are still available. Through the consultation process, it was pointed out to us that if there was an interpretation that says it may have been taken away from the courts, that wasn't the intent, so we changed that in response to some of the issues that were raised and raised by Keith. So, and also Keith works with Peter, so raised by that group. Certainly that wasn't the intent to take it out of the court, and certainly Minister Sartor put it back in the court. I just need to add, though, that what we've done with the changes to the Act is to give more accountability and more transparency to any of these decisions, in that previously we didn't have to advertise any of these leases we'll enter into. We now do for any lease, any substantial lease. That previously was only for leases in Kosciuszko. We've also now got, the Minister now refers any lease to the Advisory Council, which is made up of a mix of stakeholders, including members of the National Parks Association and a whole range of other stakeholders for their advice. He has to take advice from the Director General of the Department that he or she is satisfied that the actual lease or the development meets the sustainability criteria. And for the first time ever, we have standards, sustainability criteria, in the Act. Mm. We've never had that before at all.
Would it be fair?
And I can understand concerns. And really, if the sustainability criteria, if you look at it, what it does is it says that large-scale motel-like or resort-style accommodation is not appropriate for national parks. And that's the first time that's ever happened.
So that, we will, really that, have will, that will never happen in national parks, is what it, you're saying. That type of development is absolutely out of the question.
New development that's not on the books already, that is about small scale, will be small scale, absolutely.
And has the primary purpose of what a national park exists for changed under this Act?
You
said before that they were about visitors having access to the park and about conservation. Have the scales been tipped more in favour of making them more accessible to visitors?
I would certainly hope the scales haven't been tipped. The objects of our Act have always included conservation and enjoyment for visitors and encouraging people to visit the parks. As I said, once we start to really drill down as to how we did that, that's when we realised that the old Act could have been read up to allow a whole range of people to come to us with things that we didn't think was appropriate. And I have to say, I don't think that's fair for my staff to be bombarded with people who want to do all sorts of weird and wonderful things. So these sustainability criteria, the changes to the Act, clearly allow National Park staff to protect the values, to actually say to people who are interested in working with us on visitor experiences. If you do want to work with us, this is the standard that you'll have to meet. This is the sort of thing we're interested in, and here it is up front. If you're not interested in small-scale ecotourism-type experiences, then really national parks aren't the place for you. And that's the first time we've ever really had that. And, you know, as I say, in terms of the head of the National Parks and Wildlife Service, that gives me a great confidence that my staff are actually well-prepared and well-versed in what is appropriate.
Okay. Peter Prineas, are you concerned that the small-scale development that Sally Barnes has been describing there that may be permissible in national parks could itself be problematic, or are you concerned that it could snowball into larger-scale development?
Well, I don't agree with Sally Barnes's view that this Act puts aside any possibility of large-scale development. There is a proposal right now in Kosciuszko National Park for a Perisher village with 239 apartments and a shopping centre. 239 apartments. Now, that is the scale of development you're getting in Kosciuszko National Park. It's quite possible that you can get, while it wouldn't be of equal scale, you could get a large development in a coastal national park under this Act and under the previous Act. And I don't agree that this Act has sufficient safeguards against that sort of thing happening. I'd like to make the point also that it's just wrong to assume, as some people have, particularly the tourism industry, that national parks are not pulling their weight in terms of the tourist industry and the tourism economy in the state. When the minister, Mr. Sartor, spoke to these amendments in Parliament, he referred to a Roy Morgan survey which said that in 2008 there were 38 million domestic visits to national parks in New South Wales, 38 million. Mm. And that is a much larger figure than the figure the tourism industry, specifically the O'Neill report, was quoting when it was criticising national park management a couple of years back. It quoted a figure of 22 million. So there's nothing really wrong with the contribution that national parks are making.
So if it ain't broke, don't fix it, I think. So what you're saying, Peter...
Look, of it.
Yeah. I'm going to move on from just discussing the situation in New South Wales and look at the picture nationally. So at this point, I will thank Sally Barnes very much for her time. Sally is the head of the National Parks and Wildlife Service in New South Wales. I want to hear from you, 1300 22 55 76. Your thoughts on what national parks exist for, principally. Is conservation the priority, or the tourism experience, or can both be balanced reasonably? Does experiencing nature require you to touch the ground lightly, or should parks also cater for changing visitor needs? Give us a call, 1300 22 55 76. Christopher has posted online, people have worked very hard to preserve the remaining natural places over the past 150 years or so. Developers have access to 94% of New South Wales. I and thousands like me won't let them get the last 6%. Thanks, Christopher. Heidi has also posted online, national parks have been starved of funds for actual conservation work. Most of the money is already spent on maintaining infrastructure while weeds run rampant. Thanks, Heidi. Let's go to Sandra in Brisbane. Hi, Sandra.
Hi, how are things?
Good, thanks.
Good. Hi, I'm a grandma now, but when I was a young mum, I found myself single again with two quite young kids. We had no money for expensive holidays, so we invested in basic camping gear. We had a tent, we had a gas cooker and not much else, often sleeping bags. Mm. And since then, we've been to probably every national park in southeast Queensland and beyond. We've been to Kirrawee, Carnarvon Gorge, Bunya Mountains. Oh, I can't think of them all. Binnaburra in the Tambourine Mountains and others. Sometimes just us, just our little family of three, or sometimes with other families, which is the best way to go.
And always in the tent.
Always in the tent, on the ground. We had the most wonderful natural experiences, kids getting lost in Carnarvon Gorge but finding their way back and all that kind of thing. Now, my son's a young dad himself now, and he said recently, Mum, that's the best thing he ever did for us, and he's doing the same thing with his kids. Mm. That's what he wants, and I would think that would be a tragedy to see these things becoming just like every other...
Even small-scale development, maybe eco-huts, that sort of thing?
The whole point of it was the sleeping on the ground with the open sky, the stars at night, the platypus and all of those. And you put that at risk when you start having buildings and you start having structures. And it was the campfire and cold showers at Carnarvon when we first went there. We've been back there since. That's the sort of, and meeting other families. Because you're camping out, you end up sharing meals and doing things with other families.
Yeah.
That's what it was all about. And not, and that would always be my son's choice now, to go camping rather than to stay in a cabin or accommodation or whatever.
Thanks, Sandra. An eloquent defence of camping in national parks and not extending the development. Tom in Grafton. Hello, Tom.
Yeah, hi. It's nice to hear the subject being discussed. I have to agree 100% with Sandra. The primary purpose of national parks in Australia, as far as I was always concerned, was the conservation of nature, not the promotion of the tourist industry. Australia is renowned worldwide for its wildlife. We have people come here from all over the world to do our national parks, to take walks, to take hikes. If they want to use tourist operators, there's already tourist operators operating, and most of the national parks are on the fringes of them. And I see this legislation as a thin end of the wedge.
So what should be provided in the parks then, Tom? What type of development?
Just very basic facilities. You need a road to get into half some of the areas, which are already there. Composting toilets are a good idea so people don't pollute the environment. And very basic services. Boardwalks to protect areas of particularly delicate habitat.
Mm.
That's all we need. People should be getting in contact with nature. If people want to have the hotel experience, they can go and stay in the hotel in the middle of Melbourne and Sydney and go and visit the local zoo.
Okay, thanks, Tom. Pretty much unanimous view so far. If you've got a different view, if you think that parks can accommodate some development, there are some eco-lodges in some of our national parks around the country that apparently don't impose too much on the environment. If you think that type of development's okay, give us a call. We can hear from you and your view. Bill in Elphinstone in Victoria. Is that Elphington, Bill?
Yeah.
Elphinstone. Where's that?
Central Victoria, okay. A little north of Kyneton and south of Bendigo.
Okay, well, great to hear from you, Bill. What do you think?
I've been going to the Snowy Mountains fishing since I was old enough to drive, and I'm now 58, going on 59. It would truly break my heart to see any more development of that area.
Mm.
It really would. We roughed it, and we still do, and we just don't want to see the iron horse and bureaucrats moving in with their money and their jobs for the boys.
Okay, I think that's clear. Thanks, Bill. I want to introduce onto Australia Talks now Evan Hall, the National Manager of Tourism for the Tourism and Transport Forum, and Tony O'Brien, the President of the National Parks Association of Queensland. I'll come to you first of all, Evan. The Transport and Tourism Forum wants more tourism in national parks. Why are national parks becoming more important for tourism?
Well, first of all, I should clarify, we want more tourism, but certainly not more development. But national parks are absolutely critical to the industry. Each year, about $250 billion is spent by national and international visitors to national parks during the course of their journey. This is of incredible economic importance to the country, and particularly to regional areas. But for all the money that tourism does create, very, very little of it goes back into the park system to achieve what the park system is supposed to achieve, which is good experiences for people while preserving the environment for the long term.
Mm.
So what we're interested in doing is creating better experiences that do have positive conservation benefits, positive economic benefits for the park system without undermining the park system. And what this basically is about coming up with richer and deeper experiences than what's currently on offer at the moment. Almost everything that's on offer in the national park system is largely do-it-yourself. It's very much for independent people, and that's fine if you feel comfortable doing that, if you grew up doing that, if you have $1,000 to spend on new camping gear for the family. But there's a lot of people who are not in that situation. They'd like to try it. And in fact, we've had a lot of research done. It shows around about 80% of people who are interested in visiting parks and visiting nature have concerns about staying overnight and, you know, creepy crawlies and safety and what's that actually going to be like? Is it worth buying all that equipment?
Evan, would require additional development of parks, you would need to provide non-camping based accommodation, for example. Is that the type of development that you think we need more of?
We're looking at first of all, we should talk about that there's experiences as well. But just coming back to the built form, I mean, we're effectively talking about someone who's going to pitch a tent for you and provide the tent for you, rather than you buy your own tent and lug it in with you. And that instantly makes the park far more available, far safer for a lot of people. And a lot of the environmental impacts are absolutely minimised. It's put on stilts, so on and so forth, and actually has less impact than independent camping as we know it at the moment. We're also talking about places in the right sites, cabins for people to stay in, just in the same sorts of locations where at the moment we've already cleared the land so that people can park the four-wheel drives and put up the Taj Mahal tents. We're not actually talking about anything more intense in terms of environmental impact. What we are talking about is somebody else providing the service for those who don't have the time, necessarily the energy, or for whom, quite simply, I'd like to visit a national park. Mm. But to me, spending my limited weekend with my family, most of the time packing the kids into the car and the gear and roughing it isn't necessarily a great way to spend a weekend.
Okay.
And we're locking a lot of people out of appreciating nature and becoming champions for the national parks into the future.
Tony O'Brien from the National Parks Association, why not respond to the needs of those types of visitors that Evan's just spoken of there, and the ones who perhaps, as he said, don't want to be lying down with the creepy crawlies?
Yeah, certainly, Paul, and there is a place for all of that. The reality is, if we look at Queensland, where we're from, that less than 5% of the state is in national parks. So we've got 95% of the state where all those sorts of things can be built. And let's take a classic example, Carnarvon Gorge, which is one of the favourite camping areas in southern Queensland. And there is a wonderful setup there where outside the park and adjacent to the park, there are two very effective, privately operated resorts. One is a sort of more upmarket one. The other one has a whole range from cabins through to very basic camping and a whole range of facilities. Now, that is the model that this can be built on. So it's why do we need to go to the precious jewels, the remaining 5% of the state, which is the only part of the state in pristine that's protected from all other sorts of development, and why do we have to do that? We would never do that to any other form of human endeavour. You know, we wouldn't do that to anything else. Why do we want to do it to those remaining natural jewels?
I suppose the argument would be because people want to be in the park having the experience, plus they want some degree of comfort. But you're saying that's not acceptable.
No, it's not acceptable, and it's because those other things can be provided. And again, if you take that example at Carnarvon Gorge, that whole range is available. People who, if they want luxury, they can have luxury, and it's a very, very short trip into the gorge, and the gorge is maintained in its pristine condition. And that's what the tourists look for. You talk to anybody from Europe or the United States who wants to come here. Why do they want to come? They don't want to see another hotel. Mm. They want to see those natural waterfalls. They want to see those moss gardens. They're the things that they want to see.
Mm. Peter Prinius, just before I let you go, the suggestion, I think, from Evan Hall was that parks are not catering really for the needs of everybody, and that they really need to do so. Is there evidence that there are some visitors who are unhappy with the standards of the parks and the amenities, the range of amenities that are on offer?
Well, I'm not sure that you can make that argument. I think I agree with the last speaker, Tony, that there's a spectrum of experiences available for you throughout the state, and when you get to the national parks and particularly the wilderness areas, you're talking about the last 5 or even 2% or 1.5% in the case of wilderness areas. And the distinctive thing about those areas is that there's a gradation, but the distinctive thing about them is that they are natural. Mm. And you go there to see nature. You don't go there because you want nature as wallpaper so that you can get a massage. You go there because you want to engage with nature, and the best way to do that is to make some concessions. Do it a little bit tough for a couple of days, sleep in a tent, put up with mosquitoes maybe, and but at the, you get a tremendous payback in terms of engagement and the things that you see and understand.
And so far, Peter, most of the callers are agreeing with that sentiment. I will let you go. Peter Prineas is a writer and former chair of the Nature Conservation Council, but we have got someone on the line who thinks that some small-scale limited development might not be too bad for our parks. Ian in Brisbane. Hi, Ian.
Hello there. Yeah. I'm enjoying the banter here, but, you know, not many of the people, I think, from the other side of the fence, as you pointed out, have come on. I mean, I went to Fraser Island a number of years ago, once and once only. The roads were absolutely shocking. That they were worse than tracks. Everybody got bounced around for about 3 hours going from one place to the other. We then stopped for lunch at a, what looked like a fairly pristine place on the beach. There was a hell of a wind and some drizzle, so we thought, oh, well, we'd better take our picnic behind the sand dunes. There was more toilet paper there than anywhere.
Mm.
So, you know, can't we have some camp areas where people who love camping, and Fraser Island is the camping mecca of Queensland, can't we have some areas where they can camp with some controlled, with some amenities there so that they don't despoil the landscape as they were doing.
Mm. Well, I'm not sure there'd be too much of a disagreement about that and people bespoiling the landscape. I don't think anybody here is advocating that. Thanks for your call, Ian. In Brisbane, you're on Australia Talks. We're talking about how much development should we allow in national parks. Evan Hall, if I can just come back to the point that Tony O'Brien made before, and that is if we can have comfortable development resorts on the fringes of these national parks, people can explore the parks during the day, they can come back at night and sleep in a comfortable bed in an air-conditioned hotel if they so desire, why do we need the developments inside the park?
Well, I think there's a couple of issues there. And firstly, I'd absolutely agree with Tony that the sheer size of the national park system in Queensland is absolutely shocking if you're trying to reach that objective of protecting biodiversity and needs to be expanded. You know, the park system throughout Australia needs to be expanded. And this is where we start coming up with some of the issues. What is the border? Why is it okay 500 metres outside the border and 500 metres inside the border is wrong? What we need to be in the situation is that we're doing is that we're expanding the park system and making them the park sustainable both economically and environmentally. So in terms of why it should be in the park, it should be in the park because it has no more impact than what people are doing independently. There is literally, once you've put in the shower facilities or put in the walking trail or the place to park the car, which is what people are currently doing and using now with their own independent tourism, there is no greater impact for somebody else putting the tent up for you or cooking a meal for you at the end of the night. What it does do, though, is bring in a whole new range of people who currently don't visit national parks. And I've got to say, it's a very specific groups. Younger women are far less likely to turn up to national parks. People from non-English speaking backgrounds are far less likely to turn up to national parks. We provide a very specific experience, and it's for those who are happy to travel independently. Yes. So those people can come in, they become champions of nature, they can participate directly as they're wanting to do with nature conservation, they can do conservation volunteer work, and they can certainly are prepared to pay a little bit more for the service than what
it's most
people
are paying for. It's an untapped market
is
what you're saying, a potential market for parks that doesn't exist at the moment because the facilities lack of facility to dissuade them from being there. There's also been the case, we've talked about this a bit on Australia Talks, that tourism's been rather in the doldrums of late. Are parks a big pull factor when it comes to tourism, and in particular international tourism, and are you suggesting that enhanced facilities might actually assist in that regard?
They definitely are a big pull factor. If you look at the great icons that define particularly Australia to overseas visitors and why they come to Australia, they'll actually reel off a list of national parks. It's Uluru, it's the Great Barrier Reef, it's Sydney Harbour and the Opera House, which is National Heritage listed. So, I mean, we're incredibly conscious of how important they are. But there's also been a huge change with both international visitors and I've got to say with Australians as well, is they're no longer merely content to come and stare. They don't want to turn up and just look. They want to turn up and they want to experience. And this is where we have a problem with the park system, where we're getting dwindling support and new people are not entering into the system to enjoy that system. Is it's very much two options. You can turn up and have a look at a lookout. It's a two-hour experience. It's heavy on infrastructure that the public's paying for. Very little return to the park system. Or you can go in and independently stay overnight because you're providing your own camping gear, so on and so forth. There's a whole range of wonderful things we could be doing with our parks that will make them more attractive, that will make people come and stay and spend money on the park system and participate in conservation. Mm. I'm talking about simple things like bush tucker tours with Indigenous guides, art and sculpture in the park, staying overnight, and you know, maybe not everybody wants to sleep on the ground. Maybe for their weekend, they'd like to have a nice stretcher prepared for them, fresh linen and a glass of wine at the end of the night. A lot of this is a bit of elitist discussion about how it is you can enjoy parks. It's certainly not about the environmental
and
impact.
And it certainly would be, I think, going against many people's perception of what spending time in national parks is all about. Tony O'Brien, anything about that makes you feel slightly uncomfortable? I mean, as Evan said, it does smack a little bit of elitism, but does it make a big impact on the environment?
No, it's very much about elitism, and in fact, that's one of the guiding principles of the establishment of national parks is that they are for the people. And the reality is going to be that as these very elite types of safari tents, you know, with the wine and the Hobbit, do you think if you were paying, say, $600 a night for that experience, you'd be happy for someone else to sort of blow in after their long day on the track and sit down beside you? I don't think that's what this is about at all. So what we're going to get is we're going to get the commercial private operators who are given exclusive use of public property to further their own commercial ends. Now, that is hardly consistent with either the ecological purpose of parks or the social purpose of parks.
What about the best practice ecotourism type of facilities that we've seen in some places around Australia? How do you feel about that?
I think they're wonderful, and there's some great examples in Queensland. For example, Graham Turner and his family have done that. The issue about this, Paul, is that the serious people, the people like the Turners, put their money up. What these people, what these new thrusts are about is asking us, the public, to financially underpin new commercial developments. That's not our role, and it's not the role of public property. Mm. The people who are creative, who are really good, like Graham Turner, have gone and created all these sorts of things, put the money up, bought their own properties. And there are many examples of that. The point is, it doesn't need to happen in national parks to achieve all the other objectives of increasing tourism, of giving the range of experiences. All those things can happen outside of parks.
You're on Australia Talks talking about how much development we should permit in national parks with Tony O'Brien from the National Parks Association of Queensland and Evan Hall, the National Manager of Tourism for the Tourism and Transport Forum. 1322 55 76. You can post online as well. Lindsay just has. Controlled and responsible development in national parks will enable more people to enjoy these public resources, says Lindsay. However, National Parks and Wildlife Service have banned leashed dog walking. If the Parks and Wildlife Service approve cafes, etc., then there is also room for responsible dog walking in regional parks, says Lindsay. Let's go to Robert in Bowral. Hi, Robert.
Hi, how are you going?
Good, thanks.
Look, I'm just hear everybody talking about the wilderness and enjoying nature, and I love that. I love experience camping and travelling through different countries. But I'm also a skier, and I don't see that when I see somebody mentioning that they want to put a hotel at Parrish, I mean, Parrish is already developed. And when I look at the experience in places like Yellowstone National Park or the Rocky Mountains in Canada, I see these amazing places that are just beautiful lodges, like, or even big hotels sometimes, in the middle of wilderness, and they're really quite fantastic.
Mm. So what you're saying is that we can accommodate some development in parks, you think?
I think so. If it's beautifully done, I think it can be aesthetically pleasing, it can be controlled, and it does bring people through. Like, if you go through the Rocky Mountains in Canada, you've got thousands of square kilometres probably of wilderness, and just the corridor through the middle of it where people can go on the road and they can get off the road and they can eat in a restaurant, stay in a hotel. But look, if you start walking within probably an hour or two, you're out by yourself anyway.
Mm. Okay, thanks, Robert. Let's go to Jenny in Mile Lakes. Hi, Jenny.
Hello. Look, I'm totally against any of these commercial developments, additional ones in national parks. I'm camped in a national park at the moment. National parks and wilderness areas are absolutely the vital part of my life.
You're calling us from a national park, are you, Jenny?
Yes.
Okay. And which park is that, sorry?
Mile Lake.
Right, that is a national park. Okay. And whereabouts is it?
It's near Bulladela on the sort of mid-north coast.
Okay. And you're totally opposed to any development at all?
Any extra development. I don't mind them using existing buildings, as, for example, the old homestead at Yengo. But I'm absolutely against these commercial developments. National parks should be for nature, principally. And if people are lucky enough to have a walk there or to camp, simply they can enjoy the nature. But the nature is absolutely number one.
Okay, thanks, Jenny. Let's go to Pear in Adaminaby. Hi, Pear.
G'day, how are you?
Good, thanks.
I welcome this debate because there's a large part of the Kosciuszko National Park which has been locked out to a large part of the population. On our side, there was a cafe that was opened by the Queen, which overlooks the whole of Eucumbene or the Snowy Mountain scheme, and it's demolished. We can't get into that area. And there's yet highways that, you know, are built by the best engineers in the world that exist. So why can't we go in there?
Here's a question. Thanks, Pear. Peter in Kingscliff is next. Hello, Peter.
Hello, Paul. Listen, I have got very severe reservations about the plans because having experienced a misplaced rally in the valley up here last year where the Minister McDonald, who has since resigned in disgrace, overturned 12 laws to impose a revhead event through national parks and World Heritage areas. And people that I know contacted Peter Garrett, who's supposed to be our environment minister, and the silence was deafening.
Look, I'm
all for sustainable developments.
Yep. Okay, I'll leave it there, Peter. I don't have time to talk about the specific case that you referred to. Perhaps you can post us the details so that people who are interested can find out more. You're on Australia Talks, and Ingrid has posted online. She thinks that there is a need for small-scale eco-cabins in parks. Maybe this should be government-funded. Not everyone is able to camp or sleep on the ground, and we need to encourage more people to use the parks, says Ingrid. And Evan, if I can come back to you, Evan Hall, if this did occur and we did put more infrastructure in parks and people were able to sleep more comfortably in them, is there a danger that the local towns nearby, where people sometimes do stay after visiting the park during the day, that they could see the tourist dollar bypass them altogether?
No, it's certainly not been our experience with tourism. We've always found that when you invest in great new visitor experiences, it draws people into those areas rather than ending up with some sort of competition over a smaller pool. So our experience has certainly been, if you see what people want, they want to engage in nature more, have a much better experience, a deeper experience, and start providing that, then people will come in and they'll start turning up to those towns. And you'll find that the regional towns will be big beneficiaries of this. And most of the spend that people still do will be well outside of the national park. It's in the service station outside the park or in the motel that they stay at the end of having done a 2-3 day walk. So there's certainly no concern there for existing operators. And I think a good example is the Bay of Fires in Tasmania, where you've got a very good privately operated eco walk there. It's to the highest levels of environmental sustainability. It's quite expensive.
I was there over Christmas, actually. Yep. Beautiful part of the world. I am going to cut you off, though, because I do want to briefly go to Julia Horn. We've got on the phone Dr. Julia Horn is from the University of Sydney. She's a historian and author of The Pursuit of Wonder: How Australia's Landscape Was Explored, Nature Discovered and Tourism Unleashed. We haven't got much time at all for Julia, unfortunately. But Julia, from a cultural, philosophical perspective, how has our relationship with nature and wilderness changed over time?
Okay, well, I think that we have to realise that, in fact, the European tradition of valuing land for its natural attractions, the sort of thing that your listeners have been talking about, is actually, we have a long historical tradition of that in Australia, which really begins from the late 18th century. It develops in the 19th century, so that by the mid-19th century, there are actually, you know, almost every colony has land acts which say, we need to preserve this land because it's beautiful or because it has a limestone cave on it. And although we didn't do that particularly well in the 19th century, there are some exceptions to that, by the 20th century, we were doing it so that, you know, really in the last 40 years, I think we probably have some of the best legislation. We started doing it in some of the best ways in the world.
Mm.
So I suppose what I'm saying is that our admiration of nature and this idea of, you know, the pursuit of wonder or natural wonders, as they were called in the 19th century, has not diminished at all. If anything, the sorts of activities that were going on in the 19th century, so people coming and looking at these things, created an even greater engagement with nature and
yes.
an even greater urgency to preserve it.
And in contrast to many other countries, Julia, Australia still has huge wilderness areas, and compared to other countries, Australia's pioneer time doesn't lie as far in the past. Do you think that impacts on how we feel about nature?
No, because how we feel about nature, that European sense, it's a European tradition, starts in the late 18th century. You see it in North America, you see it in Europe. And that you also see in Australia from, you know, the time of European colonisation. So in some ways, we have, we've often been at the forefront. I think Sally from the National Parks of in New South Wales pointed out that, you know, we had the second national park, which was established in 1879. Well, in fact, you can say that preserving natural wonders starts much earlier. It starts in Tasmania in the late 1850s, in New South Wales in the early 1860s. So we have not so much followed the world, but, you know, we've often been leaders ourselves.
Mm.
There have been good periods, there have been bad periods, but Australia has actually been out in the front of wanting to preserve and really appreciate nature.
Yes. Julia, I'm going to go to a call now because someone's bringing up the issue of camping for those people with a disability, which is an issue we haven't brought up. So thanks to Dr. Julia Horn from the University of Sydney. And Stephanie from Hobart is on the line. Hello, Stephanie.
Yes, and I'm not just talking about obvious physical disabilities. I'm talking about people with health problems who are really ill or complications, people who won't sleep camping or just, it's just impossible. I'm too ill to go anywhere at the moment, but there are a lot of people like me that it's just, life is so difficult to camp, you just couldn't do it. So I'm not for big developments in parks, but the people opposing are so negative, saying you should just camp, but you have to be fairly well and able-bodied and, you know, it would be nice to have something so that people could still be in the park and not have to pay expensive motels out next to parks, you know, so then something that would help our society, good at ignoring people like this, you know, although people with obvious disabilities tend to get more attention, but other people, just because of health problems, it just makes life difficult.
Yeah, it's a good point that you raise. I've got about 20 seconds, Tony O'Brien. Is there any response you'd like to make to the point that was raised by Stephanie?
Yes, certainly. Stephanie's point is certainly valid if those sorts of facilities are provided again in other circumstances. And there are many of those sorts of camping areas. Again, it's why should it all be actually now built in the parks.
Mm.
They're the jewels. We wouldn't go and add those things to anywhere else.
Good to talk to Tony O'Brien, President of the National Parks Association of Queensland, and also Evan Hall, the National Manager for Tourism with the Tourism and Transport Forum. That's it for Australia Talks for today. For Australia Talks for this week, but you can, of course, keep the discussion going on our message board. Just head to abc.net.au/rn/Australia Talks. You can also download the show while you're there. I'm back with you again tomorrow with Big Ideas, and I'll be in conversation with former High Court Judge Michael Kirby. Have a great evening on Radio National. Don't forget Philip Adams with Late Night Live coming up after the news at 10. I'll speak to you again tomorrow.
is a document of great democratic legitimacy.
Our Constitution is the single most important document in Australian history.
It is the Constitution that has provided us with 100 years of safe, stable democracy.
I'm Damien Carrick. Join me on Big Ideas with Greg Craven, Carmen Lawrence, Michael Kirby and Larissa Berendt as we take a close look at the Australian Constitution. Have a listen or download from the Radio National website.